This morning's scripture is from Matthew 19, verses 13 to 15. Then people brought little children to Jesus for him to place his hands on them and pray for them. But the disciples rebuked them. Jesus said, "Let the little children come to me, and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these." When he had placed his hands on them, he went on from there. The word of God for the people of God.
And you know, you came to church on Memorial Day. Can I just tell you I'm so impressed with you? Can I tell you that? If you want to feel mildly superior today, you can. You really can. I think if you're online today, it's a beautiful day out there, and you're worshiping God and beginning your week this way, I am heartily impressed. I'm so impressed I took my jacket off. Let's bow our heads for a word of prayer. Lord, I pray that the words of my mouth and the meditation of all of our hearts would be acceptable to you. You, O Lord, are our strength and our Redeemer. You are good to us that in times of preaching, you sometimes use words that have been prepared, and I pray that they've all been prepared in the light of your grace. But even in the act of preaching, there are times that you speak to us in ways that leave us feeling that you have spoken to each one of us individually. And I pray that that would be the experience of those who listen this day. In Christ's name, amen. I want you to think about kids today. And there's something about children. Take a look at these pictures on the screen. Look at the faces of these kids. Doesn't matter if they're yours or not. Doesn't matter whose they are. They're just, because they're kids, there's just something very special about children. I cannot figure out what their superpower is, but they've got one. Have you noticed that? And they just sort of suck you in, don't they? All those different faces. And it doesn't, like I said, doesn't even matter if they're your kid or somebody else's kid or where they live. Years ago, Karen and I were taking our daughter Rebecca. I bet she was about 4 years old. She was in that phase of life where kids love dinosaurs. You know what I'm talking about? Where everything, it's all things dinosaur. And from preschool, she had this good friend and a neighbor whose name was James. And we lived out in the Shenandoah Valley at that time. And so we decided we were going to take him down to the Smithsonian to see the dinosaurs. So we got up early in the morning because we wanted to be there right when the museum opened. Because, you know, little kids fade as the day goes on. So we wanted to get them when their energy was high. So we got up early. We got them in the car. We drove down to Washington. We went to the Smithsonian. And then it came that time we weren't sure if we should have lunch there. Because I believe, honestly, we weren't there that long. You know, kids and museums, you know, there's a limited shelf life there. And so we decided not to have lunch there. We thought, we'll just drive home and have a late lunch, and that'll be great. Well, by the time we got in the car, we buckled the kids in their car seats, and we were driving back. And it was probably about 1 o'clock, and I was really hungry. I mean, I was just, gentlemen, do you have those moments where you are starving to death, but the rest of your family's like, no, I'm good, I'm fine. But do you have those? And if you've got a higher metabolism rate, this can be catastrophic to attitude. And so we had to get gas, and so I pulled in, and there was a Subway attached to the gas station. I thought, all is well. So I said to Karen, hey, should I get something for the kids? and the kids were asleep in the back by this time. They were just sound asleep. She said, no, they'll be fine. So I got myself a 6-inch turkey sub from Subway. Right? You know what I'm talking about? Would we all agree that is not a large sandwich? Is that fair? That's a meager lunch. It's a meager lunch. So I got my 6-inch sub, and I thought, just a little something. And so I got in the car, and we were setting off on our journey. But you know the paper at Subway, how crinkly it is? So by the time I unwrapped the 6-inch sandwich, the crinkle, crinkle, the kids just, boom, they came right awake. And it wasn't long before I heard this little voice in the back, and I heard James, he went, "Mr. Tom?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I've eaten a little sandwich here, James." "Mr. Tom?" I said, "Yes, James. What kind of sandwich is that?" And I said, "Well, it's a turkey sub." Pause. "Mr. Tom?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Sometimes the boy is hungry and could use a turkey sandwich." And Karen just looked at me. She just looked at me. We still use this line today in our family, by the way. whenever one of us is hungry. But she turned and looked at me, and just with a smile that just said, "It's over for you." Why? Because there's something about a kid, right? And so pretty soon my 6-inch sub was a 1-inch sub, and I was, you know, she was tearing it in half and passing it back, and each of the kids was eating just a tiny little bit of a sandwich. And why do you do that? Listen, everybody here, if you have kids in your life, if you've got kids in your life, you've got a story just like that, I bet. I bet you've got a story just like that, where you gave your lunch to a kid. Why do they have that power? I mean, it seems like we're bigger. It seems like we ought to just be able to say, "No, I'm bigger than you. That's why you're not going to eat my lunch." But you don't. You just give them your lunch. If you have a story like that, or if you have a compulsion that runs along those lines, it is one of the ways that you are like Jesus. Jesus talks about children in the Gospels, and in what you heard Roger read this morning, there was a day that children were coming to see Jesus, and parents, I think what was happening is parents were actually bringing the children to be blessed by Jesus, that he would pray that God's blessing would fall on their lives. People could see the uniqueness of Jesus' ministry, the proximity of Jesus to the Creator, and they were seeking that for their children. And when they came forward, the disciples had a different way of looking. They said, "He's really important and children aren't." I think this was the thought process. "He's really important, but kids aren't. And so they shouldn't be what? Bothering him. They shouldn't be bothering Jesus." And Jesus almost sort of laughs at this, and he said, No. Let the children come to me. You know, he talks about children a lot. He talks about children at different times. He says, "You know what, if you really want to understand how to have faith, think about kids." And I've never been quite sure what it was that he saw, but I suspect, you know, we have a belief that we each have been created with the imprint of God, the image of God imprinted upon each of us. That beautiful aspect of God's personhood is on each one of us. And I think that when you see kids, I think what Jesus was after when he said, if you want to have a good faith, be like a child. I think children have this untarnished peace to them. They haven't committed their own sins that they know of. They may have done things that were wrong, but quite often children aren't acting in willful ways. They're just acting as people. And they have not been tarnished by the sins of society, the sort of the structural evil of society. And because they're just untarnished, and I think Jesus was saying, if you can get to the place where you're untarnished by evil and by sin, your relationship with God's going to be very different. Be like a child. I don't know. I don't know if that's what he was saying. But here's what I do know. It's obvious that children are valuable to Jesus, that he sees not himself as important, but he sees children as important. And so if you kind of have a sense of that, and you carry a sense of that in your own life, then that's one way in which you are like Jesus. And it's not just Jesus. I think the other thing about this is he also loves the vulnerable, and he reflects the Bible as a whole, not just his teaching, but the Bible as a whole has strong teaching around the vulnerable, and children are very vulnerable. Children are disproportionately affected by issues of poverty, hunger, and violence, for instance. Look at any statistics from the UN, the World Health Organization, the Census Bureau. Look at any statistics. You'll find that children disproportionately experience vulnerability. And the Bible speaks a lot about that, and Jesus spoke a lot about that. But if you go back into Deuteronomy, and you can find this, give generously to them. And that doesn't refer just to children. That refers to people that are vulnerable. And do so without a grudging heart. I love that. Give generously and do it without a grudging heart. Then, because of this, the Lord your God will bless you in all of your work and in everything you put your hand to, because there will always be poor people in the land. Remember how Jesus said that one time? He was quoting the Old Testament. Well, the Hebrew Bible. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed. Say that with me. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed toward your fellow Israelites and the poor and needy in your land. Notice how it says, toward your fellow Israelites and, who are poor and needy in your land. You got to pay attention to your people. Remember how that time that guy came to Jesus and said, hey, who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? Well, neighbor can get a pretty broad definition if you hang around with Jesus long enough. It's not just in Deuteronomy. You're also going to find this in the Proverbs. You know, those little wisdom sayings. Do not withhold good from those to whom it is due when it is in your power to act. Don't withhold good to those whom... You know, children. You know one of the things I love about ministries related to children in the church? It's one of the few things in the church we don't argue about. Right? I mean, because if you just say, hey, we shouldn't help children, you're just a bad person. Right? I mean, do you see what I'm saying? Do not withhold good from those to whom it is due. Look in Isaiah, two passages in Isaiah. One is in Isaiah 30. Yet the Lord longs to be gracious to you, therefore he will rise up to show you compassion. For the Lord your God, for the Lord is a God of justice, and blessed are those who wait for him. And this is saying not so much you go be compassionate or you show justice. It is to say it is the nature of God. It is the nature of the Almighty to have compassion and justice is a priority. Be like God. It's in the first chapter of Isaiah, just one of the first verses. Isaiah 1, learn to do right, seek justice, defend the oppressed, take up the cause of the fatherless, plead the case of the widow. You know that old stereotype, how God's mean in the Old Testament and really nice in the New Testament. It's just not true. It's based on a lack of reading, a lack of study. Again and again, we see the nature of God caring for the poor and the oppressed. And these are pieces that are so important to the nature of Christ. Two key places where children experience vulnerability that I want to talk about today. One is in the area of health. It would be nutrition, sanitation, prevention, and treatment of disease. The other is in education. And the ability to receive a foundational education that equips you to deal with life. Now, if you're Methodist, I know we've got some guests from outside today, but you're in a United Methodist Church. Our history goes back to the 1700s, where an Anglican priest, a Church of England priest, whose name was John Wesley, and his brother Charles started a renewal movement within the Church of England. And that renewal movement eventually grew to be a church unto itself, especially when it came to America, and we had that very unfortunate American Revolution that divided, and so we needed churches here, and that's a brief history of Methodism right there. But I share that with you because what I'm going to talk about today, and if you're new here, I'm in this series on the Imagine Campaign. We're talking about these initiatives that our church is undertaking. So just to give you context for the sermon, next week is Imagine Sunday, and that's what I hope I really put in the offering plate today about if you're coming and so on. But the reason I share this with you is what I'm proposing, what the church is proposing and I'm speaking to, is not new. It's actually ancient. I really believe that churches are wise not to do new things, but to do new things that are based on all the old values. Now, Methodists are uniquely interested in children and uniquely interested in the education of children and in the care and welfare of children. So why do I say that? Because some believe that the idea of literacy, teaching literacy to children in society, actually goes back to the Methodists. Some say that John Wesley was dealing with this as early as 1740. There is a very famous Methodist I'm going to introduce you to in a minute who we know was doing it on a wide scale by the 1780s. Why was literacy in England in the 1700s so important? Because in the 1700s, there were two factors that were affecting children in England. Number one, only the wealthy went to school because there was no public education. Society was not providing education, so you had to pay a tutor or you had to pay to go to private school. And if you could not afford a tutor, and if you could not afford a private school, you simply weren't educated. And when I say you weren't educated, I mean you didn't write and you didn't know arithmetic, and you didn't read. The second thing that was happening is that children were being used in the labor force. And so children, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I'm talking as young as 10, those children were working in some of the very first factories that were ever made. And if you go to work from that age on, you're never going to learn to read or write or do arithmetic. And so people like John Wesley started to look at that, and they said, you know what, if the kids are occupied Monday through Saturday, because the work week was Monday through Saturday, then when could we educate them? What day of the week would be left? Not a hard question. Sunday, so we should have school on Sunday, and that gave rise to what we now call Sunday school. And Sunday school was not geared like many of us grew up going to, or we offer even today. It was a time when you came to the church, and the church used the Bible to teach you how to read. It was, for many kids in England, it was one of the only forms of education. In about 1780, there was a man who was called a Methodist. His name was Robert Raikes. Robert Raikes in England was a newspaperman and a publisher, and he made Sunday school extremely popular. And by 1784, there were over 200,000 children in England who were being educated in churches on Sunday, and the Methodist had a unique role in that. Now, what was interesting is most of the children that were being educated, guess what gender they were? They were male. Because when people thought education, they tended to think of men in those times. And so there was another woman whose name was Hannah Moore. And this is Hannah Moore. And she's also a fashion person. I mean, look at that. Seriously, that's an outfit. Wouldn't you agree? Hannah Moore and her sister started several schools in the area of England she lived. She was a powerful woman. She, when I say powerful, she lived a powerful life. She was a contemporary and a friend of William Wilberforce and John Wesley, both of whom were abolitionists, and she was a part of the force of people that was called the Clampton sect, and they helped end slavery in England in their day. She and her sister founded Sunday school in her community. And they started one. They got up to the point where they had started 9 of these Sunday schools. And her focus was on female children. And she actually wrote a series of books, one of which was about the education of children. And so she was, in her day, considered a staunch feminist. Why? Because she believed that children who were female should be literate and know how to add and subtract. And in those days, If you believe in that, you are considered a feminist. And I'm going to read you a quote from one source I found. Hannah Moore's views and activities became the focus of a struggle between the evangelical wing of the Church of England. Now, evangelical has been used in a lot of different ways in America in our time, so let me give you context for that time. What it meant was these were people who believed everybody should know Jesus, and they believed the church should be a vital and powerful place to attend, and it shouldn't bore people to death. Essentially, that's what evangelical meant in those days. But they also believed this: the evangelical wing of the Anglican church looked to Sunday schools and similar activities as the way forward. And then there was a more traditional wing that viewed, okay, so there's a wing over here of the Church of England, and they view that wing as a group who were proposing Methodist activities and programs. And so this group, who was the more traditional view, looked at that group, which is where the Methodists were, and they said, shame, shame on you. Shame, shame, because those activities are, get this word, dangerous. Friends, there was a time when our people were considered dangerous. I mean, when I read that, I was so happy. I'm not joking. I was like, go Hannah Moore, man. She was dangerous. And as the Sunday school movement developed, the Methodists became more organized, and the reaction only grew. So the more children that the church blessed, the more people on the traditional side said, they're more and more dangerous, because they don't just educate boys. They educate who? Girls. The bishop sent out an email that Barbara told you about this past week. You know what we worried about the danger of the Methodist Church in our time? That it's going to die. That's the big danger we're in now. Do you know why we're in that danger? Because we're no longer dangerous. And the reason that we're no longer dangerous is that Methodists and local churches have forgotten that God's called them to be a place of blessing and a source of grace for their communities. But when churches, United Methodist churches, and I can only speak to the tradition I'm in, but when United Methodist churches remember that there are people to be blessed and that children are disproportionately vulnerable and that it really does matter, they become alive and well and thrive. And you might say to me, Tom, is it really that simple? And I want to tell you something. I travel around to different annual conferences and to different districts and to different churches, and I've had the opportunity to speak in many places and talk to lots of people, and here's what I want to tell you. It's about that simple. And it seems to me that that matters. Now, two of the initiatives of our Imagine campaign focus on children who are vulnerable, and the first is an educational initiative. We all know that across America, there are schools that are struggling today. Schools that are struggling to meet basic standards of education in the states in which they are located. And these standards are kind of important because if you don't meet a certain standard of education, you're not going to be well prepared to live and work in America, which is a very fast, technologically evolving society. And there are many reasons that children aren't learning well across America. Some children, and I just want to speak to issues of poverty today, some children struggle disproportionately because their school that they're in has a large pocket of children who come from an impoverished socioeconomic zone. And when you grow up in poverty as a child, it means statistically that you are more likely to not have the same nourishment level as a child who comes from a home that is more wealthy. It means that you might not have a great dinner that night. It means that when you get up in the morning, you may have to get yourself out of bed and no adult's going to stand there and say, "Have you eaten your breakfast?" And so when you enter the classroom in the morning, you may not be physically ready to do learning because your physical is attached. This is attached to this. It means if you come from a pocket of poverty, it means that maybe you've got a parent who is working two jobs, maybe even three jobs, to make ends meet because they don't make as much money per hour, and so they have to increase the volume of hours that they work. If you come from an impoverished space in American society, you are more likely to be raised by a single parent, a male or female, who, and I'm not talking about a joint custody situation where there's another parent that's also helping with the child. I'm talking about a single parent situation where there's nobody else but that adult, and there may not be any extended family around them at all. You may grow up in a high-risk neighborhood where there's lots of opportunity to get in lots of trouble. There are just so many factors that are influencing what's happening in the school before kids ever enter the school building, much less the problems of the school themselves. Maybe there's a language issue because your parents came from another country and wanted to pursue the American dream and all that people have come to America since my people came in the 1700s and yours probably came, maybe a year ago or maybe 100 years ago. It doesn't much matter. They were all pursuing the same thing. It's one of the reasons we do our English as a Second Language program down at Hutchison now. Well, the Hartford Institute on Religious Research published these figures a couple years ago. Roughly, there are about 98,800 public schools in America. And then you ask yourself, but how many of those schools have distinct pockets of poverty that are included in the broader population that makes up that school? That number is about 44,500 schools. So just hold that. Don't put up that next figure. Here's the question I want you to think about. How many churches are there in America, roughly? How many churches do you think there are in America? Just shout out a name. Somebody said 100,000. Somebody said 300,000. Here's the right answer. About 322,000 churches. Now, here's what I want you to think about. What if only half of the churches cared about children in poverty? Okay, let's just say only half of the, we can only convince that half of the churches in America would get involved. You know what that means? And if they would focus their attention on schools that had a population that came from a lower socioeconomic sector, that would be about 160,000 churches focusing on about 44,500 schools. We'd be playing 1-on-4 basketball with poverty. 4-on-1. There would be four of us to every one school. And that, I think, could be a game-changing revolution in America. And you know the reason that why that's not going to happen? If it doesn't happen, you know why it won't happen? Because people in churches will say this. They'll just say this. What's it matter? What's it matter? I mean, what's it matter? Can we really do anything? You know, I love the victimization and the powerlessness that Christians often speak of. We can't really do anything. But I want you to remember the faces of the children when the sermon opened, and I want you to ask yourself something. Does it matter? Does it matter? Does it matter? If it doesn't matter to us, does it matter to Jesus? He who said, "Let the children come unto me." I mean, if you just go down the street to Hutchison, it's just a couple miles away. I'll never forget that social worker years ago. And we said, if we want to do something with children who are experiencing poverty, where do we go? And she rolled open this map, and she said, based on the community assessment we've done, you should go right here to the school, and you should say to the principal, what can we do? And we've done that every year since. Now, if you look at the statistics just of Hutchison Elementary, which is where we've had this partnership that's over, I don't know, 10, 15 years now, 70% of the kids in that school participate in free and reduced lunch. 64% have limited English language proficiency. 57% are enrolled in ESOL, and they have a 25% mobility rate, which means that during the year, they may be moving. Our daughter, our oldest daughter, Rebecca, teaches in an urban school in Memphis, Tennessee, which is one of the lowest performing school systems in America. And she was talking to me on the phone last year, and just heartbreaking. And she said, Dad, this girl I've been working with all year to improve her situation and try to get her toward the grade level that she should be on, came in the other day and said, Mom had a fight with Grandma, and we've got to move out. And she's moving to another part of the city of Memphis. And she said, Dad, every time I lose a kid to a move, we lose the progress they've made. It's just, what's it matter? What's it matter? Well, you can see why kids at Hutchison might be struggling, some of them, to make the state standards of learning. Not all, but some. And the idea that is before you in the Imagine campaign is that we might, over the next 1 to 2 years, create a plan with the school, and the school would be the driver of the plan. And we've got some important things we've got to iron out before we start this, like what's the financial sustainability on a 5-year or a 10-year model? What's the metrics? What are the metrics you're trying to change through the program, et cetera? So there's a lot to be worked out. But why do I share that with you? Because imagine if we would have an after-school program that would extend the learning day, provide afternoon supervision that would be fun for the kids, and also provide a nutritional snack at the end of the school day. Imagine how different a child's life might be if they got all their homework done before they left the school and went home. Just imagine. Now, the second initiative has to do with children, but it has to do with a world health thing. And so we're going to go all the way across the globe to Sierra Leone, Africa. And if you're new here, this church has had a relationship with the United Methodist Church in Sierra Leone since the year 2000. We first started with the Child Rescue Center, which currently today deals with child trafficking and child labor issues, and we affect about 350 children at any given time right now. Any given day. We also started a hospital there with 13 other partner churches, and that hospital today also has remote village outreach clinics. And so the executive director of Helping Children Worldwide, which is the nonprofit we started to kind of focus on all this work, Jenny Wagner, is going to talk to you right now about the second initiative that I'm going to share today.
Sierra Leone has the worst child survival rate in the world. The worst. It's the worst. To be a child in Sierra Leone is more dangerous than being a child anywhere else in the world. More than 20% of children born in Sierra Leone will not celebrate their 5th birthday. They will die before they reach the age of 5. Mercy Hospital is focused on maternal and child survival. In Sierra Leone, 1 in 23 women die during childbirth. 1 in 23, and that is a statistic that has improved over the last 5 years. But if you look around the congregation and you think 1 in 23 of these women, 1 in 23 of these moms, these wives, these sisters or daughters would not be here, that is a huge impact to the community. Initially, we will partner with 15 to 20 villages that are within a 10-mile radius of the hospital. The hospital will provide the infrastructure to support the program. We're talking about things like some of the supplies, the ambulance. We will engage the Mercy Hospital staff to provide support. The United Methodist Committee on Relief, UMCOR, is coming in with the project manager. And this project manager has executed programs similar to this in neighboring countries like Liberia and had great deals of success with that. I believe that we as Christians are called to make this difference and to change these outcomes. Jesus Christ tells us in Matthew 25 that when we care for the least of these, his brothers, we care for him. And these people in the villages are the least of these. We are called to care for them. And if I could change the outcome for just one family, for just one mother, that would be enough for me. But this initiative allows us to have a much bigger impact than that. It will literally transform thousands of lives, entire communities that will change. And when this initiative reaches its successful conclusion, we will have healthy communities where women and men raise their families together, where children are healthy and happy and carefree and laughing and going to school. This is success, and this is God honoring, and this is why it matters.
So this initiative is going to do three basic things. The first thing it's going to do is to teach villages, people in villages, to identify and to focus on their own community health needs and put the onus on the members of the village through training to identify, hey, this is what we need to do for women to live longer and children to live longer and not die of diseases like malaria or nutrition issues or other things. The second thing it's going to do, and I think we've got a slide for this that I probably didn't highlight. The second thing is to empower community health volunteers to actually train people to have to walk around the village and say, hey, are you using your bed net for malaria? Hey, do you if you're having, how are you doing with those checkups? Have you been to your prenatal care that the hospital is going to come and do in the village? Friends, can I tell you something? A teenage girl in Sierra Leone is more likely to die in childbirth than she is to graduate from high school. Did you hear that? She's more likely to die in childbirth than she is to graduate from high school. And you think about the privilege of education we have here. All that started at one point because people started doing community organization. And then the third one, no, leave that back up there. The third one is to increase prenatal care, nutritional support, and malaria treatment. You know, a lot of children die of malaria because of a combination of factors. Before they got malaria, they were already malnourished, and then they're little, you know, they're vulnerable, but just because they're little. And so between the combination of malnourishment being the age they're at and then the disease of malaria without medical care, that's why so many kids are dying under the age of 5. That's one of the key reasons that so many kids are dying under the age of 5 in sub-Saharan Africa and certainly in Sierra Leone. So that's that initiative. These two initiatives together, we think if we could raise about $400,000 that would go towards those initiatives, we think there would be a measurable decrease in deaths in Sierra Leone, and we think we can start a sustainable after-school program down the street because of the seed money that'll be required to do that. And we will be one of the biggest community partners in Fairfax County, which I think matters because a lot of our for-profit businesses that are multinational organizations, many of them, are invested in these schools, but not that invested, nothing like what we're talking about. And frankly, I would like to go with the Principal Hutchison and start walking around their office and saying, hey, I know that your multinational corporation has given $5,000 last year, but you might step up with the big boys on this one, the big girls on this one, and do something that really matters. And friends, I got to tell you something. I didn't get a calling to be an educator. My wife has that calling. My daughters seem to be exhibiting that calling, a couple of them. But I'll tell you this. I would gladly give my money, and I wouldn't do it grudgingly. I would gladly give. We are gladly going to give to this because we've just answered a question in our heads. What's it matter? What's it matter if a child is properly educated? What's it matter if a mother dies? What's it matter if a child perishes when they could have had loved life that was life? And with my one and only life, I am trying to figure out how to be like Jesus. And I'm not saying Jesus would give to the Imagine campaign. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is this. We've tried to find initiatives in this church that would reflect the heart and will of God in our world today. And it's odd preaching to you. I've been feeling a little odd. Wow, this doesn't feel like a normal Sunday. It doesn't feel like a normal sermon. But friends, if we don't think about what's happening out there and what Christ would have us do in here, then we haven't really worshiped. And so that's my sermon. Thank you for being here on Memorial Day. I think you're fabulous that you came on a holiday. I was afraid it would just be me. All alone. And look at you. You're all here. So God bless you.